look at these.
Any Germans?
They're too bright, I can't see.
Reload, he's moving fast!
Everybody keep calm, we're gonna take care of this.
This is Red Eyes Creations Radio. Greetings to new or regular listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are recording from the west coast of Sweden. Wherever you are, a warm welcome to the program. The website is redicecreations.com, our home on the web, where you can find our radio archives, our member section, news, links, resources and much more. And soon we are going to do our first live program. We are still storing out a few technical details, but much more is to come, so stay tuned. We'll soon be up and running. Today we are going to dive into the topics of UFOs and talk about the fascinating subject of Foo Fighters, balls of fire, ghost rockets and whatnot. We're going to focus on the period in and around the Second World War. We have Keith Chester joining us today, and he is the author to the book Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. I'm going to have all the links up on our information page on Red Eyes Creations with related articles and links to how you can find the book and much more, so you can continue reading from there and on all the topics that we'll be discussing here today. So take a look at redeyescreations.com for much more on that. Okay, so it's going to be very interesting today, diving into these subjects together with Keith. We're glad he's joined us here today. So welcome to the program, Keith. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks, Henrik. It's a real pleasure and honor to be on your show. I'm glad you invited me on.
Excellent. Yeah, it's nice to have you. Thank you again for coming on. You know, as we usually do when we have a new guest on the program, before we kind of dive into the main topic of today's program, where I would like to spend some time to talk a little bit about your background and interest when it comes to this subject in regards to UFOs. Then, when did this start for you, and was there any kind of specific event, I guess, in your life that kind of got you into this research?
Yes, the year was around 1966. I live on the east coast of the United States in the state of Maryland. It was a daytime sighting. I was living along the Catoctin mountain line. And so the mountains were behind me, but it was full daylight, I guess the summer, around 5:30 p.m. And I was running down my front yard, and I looked across the field, which was several hundred yards away, and there was a tree line. And above those trees, I saw a large, round, orangish-red ball, just motionless, hanging above the trees. Now, I was 11 years old, so my hand at full extension could encompass and hold it like a basketball. So I wasn't sure if it was huge and very close or far away. I wasn't sure at the time. All I know is that it scared me. I ran inside my neighbor's house to get my friend. We came back out, and it was gone. It was a clear sky. There was no wind. And I, you know, was alarmed. I told my parents, and they listened to my story. But, you know, after it was all over, I continued on with the day. But later in the week, my mother said to me, you know, that thing you saw, they were saying on the news that there were weather balloon sightings. So even as a child, I realized that that was no weather balloons, because I had seen so much aerial activity. I lived out in the country. And it was fairly desolate. The biplanes would come out and practice their aerobatics for shows. I would see lots of helicopter activity because the Vietnam War was in full swing, or getting ready to. And I was fairly close to Camp David. I was I lived probably 30 minutes from Camp David in along the mountain line. So to see the presidential helicopters come over my house was a fairly normal observation.
Sure.
Whatever this was, I still do not believe it was a weather balloon, for one. It just did not resemble the solid, like I said, orange-red ball. So that was in 1969, 66.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had an interest throughout and occasionally would read all the books that would come out during those years. And by 1989, I started to take on the role of investigations. I had come across a friend who was in high school in 1987, and an English teacher of their class had spoken about knowing about UFOs. And I say it was in relationship to all the hubbub of activity over Roswell. Roswell started coming out in the press around that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher's figure, since the press was releasing the information, she felt comfortable in speaking with it to her class. Her story was that in the year 1969, she worked for CETA. She was employed by CETA, which was a civilian employment training agency for people who were going to college to give them jobs during the summer to help pay for school. Her job was to work in the Pentagon for the Office of Civil Defense, and she was a secretary to an Army Colonel Sullivan. Now, her office was very small. It was herself and Colonel Sullivan. And one day during that summer, there was a meeting within Colonel Sullivan's office, and she could not help but overhear other officers, she believed they were all Army, were discussing what they should do with the remains of a UFO. And she tried her best not to listen, but could not miss that information. So later on that summer, something happened at the Office of Civil Defense. A library, something was broken into. There was a real scandal that took place. And she became under investigation by the FBI, her family and friends, and it scared her. So she never really spoke much more about her employment there until, of course, this incident. So I decided to try to find out exactly what it was she heard for myself. And before doing so, I contacted Leonard Stringfield, who was a well-known crash and retrieval specialist at the time. Of course, he had a long history involved with UFOs,
right,
going back to the World War II. So when I called Mr. Stringfield out of the blue, I asked him if he wouldn't mind helping guide me in approaching this person and give me some tips on interview techniques,
mm-hmm,
so I didn't scare her off or I didn't lead with any kind of questions.
Sure.
And he was more than glad to. We became fast friends from that moment on. And so that was how it directly put me in connection to Mr. Stringfield.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, of course, I had known about Mr. Stringfield's World War II sighting. But during the course of our friendship, I heard him speak about the observation, of course, on the telephone to me, and it was fascinating. I became more fascinated with the subject because I had an interest in World War II. So one thing led to another, and I decided to, by 1999, go into full-time research regarding World War II in honor of Mr. Stringfield's sighting, because I felt that it was so fascinating, there had to be more. So what I had to figure out first was what kind of material existed, what was out there regarding World War II that was available to the general public. And there was a lot here and there. There would be magazine articles. A lot of the older books would devote a chapter, I mean a paragraph or two, sometimes a chapter. But as a whole, it was hard to track down. And it really did not give you a good picture of what was happening. So I amassed that. Then I said I needed to have documentation. I needed some piece of documentation that would validate my investigation at the National Archives, because I felt that in order to really pursue this, I needed to find authentic documentation, not just rely on other author or researchers' work.
Sure.
So what I did, I contacted historian researchers Barry Greenwood and Jan Aldridge. Jan Aldrich, your listeners may know, was, or still is, the director of Project 1947.
Mm-hmm.
And Barry Greenwood is a well-known historian on the UFO phenomenon going back many years. I'd say the 1960s, if I have it correctly. I hope I am right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked them if they had any key documentation that would that I could really get on my feet and running to determine where I needed to go. So basically what I received was information regarding the 415th Night Fighter Squadron. And that information had to do a lot with what they call the Foo Fighter sighting.
Sure.
So I looked at that and realized, well, there were very large gaps, and there was in actuality very little documentation, official documentation that I could see.
Mm-hmm.
But because of what I had in my hands at the time, I said, well, I'll just go into the record groups at the archives and look for myself, find these same reports, and then just backtrack and just see what I can find. And before even going that far, I wanted something that really showed me that there was a definite phenomenon that existed during the war, and it was actually acknowledged by official authorities.
Right.
And that came with the Robertson Panel report. And, of course, the Robertson Panel had convened in Washington, D.C. in January 1953 to determine if UFOs were a national security threat. There was a real concern that if the UFO phenomenon was used as propaganda, the Soviet Union could actually clog the communication lines with, let's say, a fake UFO sighting, whatever they determine, and then launch a low-altitude intercontraballistic missile strike in the U.S.
Sure.
And so I determined that that report was really the groundwork that kept me to pursue this investigation, because within it there was a section called On Lack of Danger, specific to World War II, and I quote, if the term flying saucers had been popular in 1943 through 1945, these objects would have been so labeled. I was actually startled by that statement and decided that, well, that was coming out of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the report itself said that the phenomena was probably meteorological, celestial phenomena, or misidentifications.
Sure.
But the fact that they put that statement in there indicated to me that something resembled the flying saucers that were being seen post-war.
Mm-hmm.
Because that term did not exist until post-war. And, it was applied to the unconventional aircraft that were being seen around the country, the United States, and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Circular aircraft that displayed unconventional aerodynamic activity. And so I felt, well, that definitely segregated it from celestial or meteorological phenomena. There was definitely something there, but the report itself seemed to be very, very vague and watered down. But it was enough to get me going. So from 1999 to 2003, I went to the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, and weekly did a search through all the record groups of the Army Air Force, the Office of Scientific Research and Development, the U.S. Army. I did the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor, and I tried to find anything to do with the wartime phenomenon.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about that, because it's very interesting. When you go into the archives like that, how is it structured? Can anybody do it? Is it easy to find things? Can you search on a computer nowadays? How does it work?
Well, the National Archives, it's getting better every year, but it's open to the general public. You can go there, and there are archivists there who will help guide you. You can know absolutely nothing about archival research and walk in and then say, here's what I'm looking for. And it can be a host of subjects. I mean, as much as you can think of a subject, it'll be there regarding World War One, World War Two, civilian and military records. And it holds, I believe, 500 record groups, Department of State, Office of Scientific Research and Development, CIA, OSS, on and on and on. And so then you determine, well, I need to see the information coming out of those offices. And then from there you get a feel of how the records are broken down. And for instance, for the military records, you would think, well, I need to see what they were reporting. So you would go to the mission reports. And you would just keep narrowing it down. Well, you need to go to the actual group or bomb level or fighter group level and then find out where those records are being kept. And there's finding these to help you along the way. So it is, it's a very easy but tedious process. The more you do it, of course, the better at it you are.
Sure.
However, it's absolutely huge in scope.
Yeah.
Meaning that the finding aids are very, very general, and a lot of times you really just have to dig in and go through the material, and that's how discoveries are made.
Interesting. And as you say, anyone can do it, but you need to like set up a time with them, call them beforehand. What's going on there?
No, you just need to show up, and you get yourself a identification badge, has your picture on it, and you're free to go there Monday through Friday.
Cool.
From 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and sometimes later, depending on the day. And as much as you want, and it's a very, 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 very interesting, and of course, quite a lot of people are involved.
Yeah.
And but it's definitely open to the public. I think that's what you're trying to find out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And a little bit about the procedure, because I constantly hear about people looking into the archives, but I never actually ask someone, you know, how it actually works, so to speak. So it's great to kind of get a little bit of insight in how it works, so to speak.
Sure. And then once you're in there, you can also, the archives, you can place a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, for information that you think is still classified.
Uh-huh. So there is information that is kind of in the archives, but is not accessible to everyone at first?
Absolutely. There are still things that are classified for a host of reasons. For instance, I know for a fact there are 1,500,000 documents of air intelligence files from 1942 to 57, somewhere in that range, probably half of that is World War II. And a lot of times the information that's classified is only because they haven't had the manpower to declassify it, or it still has terminology or information that for whatever reason the intelligence agency who supplied it to the archives feel that it still is something worth keeping. Now, why, my question is, why so much kept from in World War II? Why so much secret? And I still think it is a degree of a manpower issue going in. A strange story, and after 2001, the attack on the World Trade Center buildings, I had put a FOIA request in. It took me about a year to get, I'd say, 100 boxes released to me that had to do with air intelligence starting in 1942. Well, after the event, the Air Force came back in and reclassified my records.
Really?
Yes, and their reason was all they had to do was find one document that said, let's say, atomic bomb. Well, the whole slew of records would be then reclassified. It was really an overreaction. And so, you know, there's lots of stories like that, and but the records are there. If you know what you're doing, and the more you do it, you can find out names of documents that you know exist.
Sure.
And then you can FOIA it. And if it is in there and still not declassified, because of the FOIA Act, they will assign someone to work on that and then get it declassified to you.
Interesting. Yeah, fascinating. I mean, you've been looking at the National Archives of the U.S. Have you also been looking at other archives? I know that constantly now, you know, it seems like almost that there are new things being released. I know that France was releasing documents from the government relating to UFO sightings, as well did the UK. Have you been looking at these too?
Unfortunately, personally, I have not, and that has to do with just time and money. I'm an hour and a half away from the College Park Archives, which are the National Archives military branch, so I could commit to doing a real focused search. Regarding the Public Records Office, which in England, I believe they're called National Archives now,
mm-hmm.
Which is confusing. I had to rely on other researchers' work.
Sure.
The same with the Italian files. I mean, a lot of research was done in Italy. Of course, the German. I mean, Russian files. Unfortunately, my search was limited to U.S. and Britain because, of course, a lot of the files were attached to the American files from Britain. So
mm-hmm.
I would see RAF information.
Mm.
So I was fortunate enough to have a good grasp on that, but I had to rely on other people regarding international archives. So my book, while in depth, is really just a tip of the iceberg, and it just lays the foundation for other researchers around the world to start to assimilate and put together the phenomenon as a whole.
Right, right. Well, fascinating. I mean, let's dive into it, so to speak, and talk a little bit about the things that you found when you went into the archives and looked. I guess a good place to start is how far back in regards to, I guess we still have to focus around the time and period of World War II, of course, but how far back around that time do we need to go to kind of begin to pick up on the first sightings of these, either if we're talking about UFOs or Foo Fighters?
Well, we have to go back to December 1933. And it does go back farther, but John Keel had started an in-depth investigation into what they called the Scandinavian sightings,
right?
Which were sightings, of course, Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And this, of course, coincided with the storm that was brewing in Europe. Hitler had come to power. So there was unprecedented amount of sightings around the world, though, that looked at through today's eyes, had similarities with the UFO sightings of current day. Now, they didn't call them UFOs. They didn't call them Foo Fighters. They were called phantom flyers, ghost aviators. And what was taking place over those three countries primarily were they were observing aircraft of some type that were performing beyond the capability of some of the best pilots in Europe. They were objects were flying in severe weather. They were flying in territories that the fuel capacity of the known aircraft did not exist. They were also flying so often that there was a real challenge in thinking regarding that. Of course, Nazi Germany's Air Force was at the time in 1933-34 were pretty much biplane carryover from World War I. Russia was almost non-existent. Economic problems around the world. The United States was too far away to do an operation of this nature. Japan was fighting China. So, looking at it through the eyes of, well, what could these be? Germany seemed to be the closest, but it wasn't matching. And John Keel dived into the investigation and found many reports that showed that the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Finnish authorities were actually authorizing investigations because, as like today, these objects were around military installations.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes, and some made noise, some didn't. Some aircraft were seen shining beams of light down to the ground. There was noise associated that did sound like aircraft. yet they could never see or describe the aircraft. There were civilian sightings. And of course, my books stay specifically with the military of it.
Yeah.
And so John Keel led the pack with that. Now, I'm sure there's been quite a bit of newer information coming out of the countries, and there are investigators that are still diving into the Scandinavian sightings.
Sure.
But to this day, overall, the sightings, some of the sightings do dictate there was some type of very unconventional aircraft.
Right, right. You know, do you say that this goes then even in Scandinavia as far back or beginning even in 1933? Because what I've read so far at least is that they kind of peaked, I guess, then in around 1946, where, you know, situations were a little bit different in regards to, you know, the Germans potentially had, you know, the V-2 rockets developed, and the Russians potentially even might have, you know, gotten a hold of test rockets themselves and firing V-2 rockets at you know, in and around 1946. But you're saying that all the way back to 1933, this was happening in Scandinavia, right?
Yes.
Hmm.
Now, with the 1946 sightings, they're called, I believe they're called the ghost rockets.
That's right, yeah.
And there was I think thousands of the sightings, and they followed a certain path. I don't think they found, for everything that they had seen, there was very little physical evidence. And from what I understand, investigations were launched to determine if it was indeed the Soviet Union firing rockets as tests.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the most popular theory today.
Sure.
But there's still the controversy still surrounds that whole period. But as far as 1933 and on, these sightings were even more spectacular because they were hovering. There were lights associated, like I said, shining down the ground, you know, just like out of Close Encounters, the movie.
Sure.
There were objects that were completely illuminated. And so there was a large gambit. And I picked 1933 because it, on the record, investigations were started by all three countries, Finland, Norway, Sweden, and they were unable to determine what it was.
They actually set up, you're right, because I read today that they set up a ghost rocket committee, basically, and there are actually archives today, military archives in Swedish, around 2,000 pages, and I know that there is a Swedish UFO organization that have been going through some of the material, and there's, you know, in some cases there are actually even photographs of these things. You know, have you heard about this?
I have, and I forget the gentleman's name who runs the archives over there. Do you happen to remember?
I don't, actually. I can dig that up later, but not right now, no.
I know, I can't. It's on the tip of my tongue, but yes, and I hope... Hopefully, I've presented my material accurately because, yes, they are conducting extensive research into that period of time.
Yeah.
So, but unfortunately, again, communication around the world was limited for my book.
Sure, sure. No, exactly. I mean, it's there's so many things. It's so interesting that these seems to be kind of popping up around the world approximately at the same time. So let's say we're beginning then at around 1933. This peaks at least in Sweden around 1946, something like that. If we were to go back and look at a little bit about what the US were reporting and even what the Germans, I guess, were reporting and the UK, the term, let's talk about the term itself, Foo Fighter. What is it that determines a Foo Fighter, do you know kind of where it all came from at the beginning, the term?
Yes. One of the biggest misconceptions is that, first of all, the term Foo Fighter was a term that started in November of 1944 and pretty much faded out by March of 1945. It was a term designated to the objects observed by members of the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, a U.S. Operational Combat Unit. And most of the men were encountering these strange lights. And they named the object the Foo Fighters after a Smokey Stover cartoon, which was a popular cartoon in the 1940s, where there was the madcap adventures of this fireman and his truck called the Foo-mobile. So that's how the name was attached. But what was taking place was there were sightings from the beginning of the war on, but they were called balls of fire, they were called circles of light, flares, jets, rockets. The terminology was not limited. It depended upon the observer and what he thought it looked like.
Sure, yeah.
And so eventually, certain objects were just called a flare, but in reality, they were called a flare because the object was illuminated, but it really didn't explain, well, flares don't travel in a horizontal path. And so the Foo Fighter really is a late-war term specific to the European theater, Italian theater of operations. And by the time the war was over in Germany, the term had actually gone back to a British term called the Balls of Fire. However, they would reference the Foo Fighters in the intelligence reports. The intelligence men would actually, you know, make reference to the Foo Fighters in European theater, and it seemed to be a whole other ball game.
Interesting.
Of course, that's where Len Stringfield had his sighting in the Pacific, over the Pacific in 1945, after the war had ended, August 28th.
All right. Would you say that his sighting? I have not heard about that, so maybe we can talk about that too. But would you say that his sighting kind of is typical for what you have found in the records? Maybe we can go into that, talk just about the kind of behavior, what happens, how long it, you know, sustains itself, and so forth.
Okay. Well, regarding Len Stringfield's sighting, his was a very remarkable sighting in terms of that it was probably close to what was being termed the Foo Fighters. A lot of times the Foo Fighters were pretty much just a ball of light in general. And circular, anywhere from the size of a fist or a baseball to the size of a full moon. Now, most were seen at night. What distinguishes Mr. Stringfield's was his was seen during the day. And he saw three in formation. And during the day, they burn like magnesium, what he said, like burning magnesium. They were about the size of a dime, teardrop-shaped. And so they were very similar to the Foo Fighters. But there were very dramatic sightings seen during the war that resembled flying saucers. With actual portholes. Some looked like giant zeppelins, but they were absolutely two or three times larger. And even some of them hovered. And then there were reports some traveled at thousands of miles per hour.
And
they go through that goes through the war. I say that the earliest wartime sighting that I would consider very, very good would be June of 1942, June 25th, Captain Ray Zabinski was a Wellington bomber pilot. He was with a Polish division attached to the RAF, Royal Air Force. And he was coming back on a night mission bombing in the Ruhr Valley. And he was flying over Holland, heading towards the North Sea. It was a clear night when his crew reported a copper-colored circular round object approaching the aircraft, and it was about the size of a full moon. The crew, he became alerted to the fact that it could be an incoming rocket, that he realized it an experimental weapon of some type. He gave the orders to his gunners to prepare to fire. When the object got within range, they opened up. Two different machine gunners, I think the belly gunner and They were hitting the object. It was close enough that he knew that the tracer rounds were making a mark on the target in terms of it had reached the target, but there was no trace of any of the tracers coming out the other side, as if it was swallowing it up.
Really?
And that startled him. And then, of course, the object was able to maneuver around his aircraft at extraordinary speed and then take off and go up into the sky and disappear among the stars. His sighting was recorded, so there is, but unfortunately, his, like many other observations, are not found in the official records.
Really?
Yes, and it comes down to the ridicule that the pilots were receiving.
Mm-hmm.
Some, in his instance, Ray Sabinsky's instance, he was laughed at. They thought he was drinking.
Sure.
He decided not to pursue it because he didn't want to be grounded. And he did his own little investigation, and some of the pilots coming in behind him had seen the same thing. So it verified in his mind, yes, he encountered something that was very, very unusual.
Huh. Yeah, that kind of makes you wonder how many people actually saw these things but didn't report on them, afraid of being ridiculed, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there were, in late war, some of the, from what I understand, some of the unit commanders absolutely refused to let their pilots use terms like Foo Fighters or anything that had to do with something science fiction related, because they didn't want to go on record as, you know, their pilots seeing something they couldn't explain.
Yeah. So, I mean, you share with us one sighting there. Is there kind of anything that stands out, I guess, in regards to, maybe we can talk about also a little bit what the difference in that regard is of what is a kind of a glowing ball and a disc and a UFO in that sense, what kind of, I guess, what separates a Foo Fighter from a more classical saucer or UFO? Is there any kind of clear difference between that?
Well, the clear difference is that some of the more remarkable sightings, there was no doubt they were observing a structured physical craft.
A more kind of nuts and bolts thing?
Nuts and bolts, absolutely.
Sure.
And where I'd say the majority of the Foo Fighters were luminous balls or luminous light or whatever it was. And I have one report where a Foo Fighter was observed, but they saw that whatever it was come up and do a wing over. They actually thought they saw a wing after it did a wing over. But that was only one report.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have to realize that everything was being termed a Foo Fighter. It got to be a point where it was very hard for me to discern what was it they were seeing.
Right.
Now, what helped me was in many of the mission reports, there was a section called Phenomena. And they would throw in there rockets. They would throw in flares. They would throw in aircraft. Because that's what it appeared to them, but they weren't sure. So at the time, they had to list it as phenomena. And then, of course, break it down into further categories, such as balloons, such as flares, rockets and jets. But when you look at the actual reports, you start to say, well, I don't know of any rockets that can do 90-degree turns. And I don't know any of rockets that were able to outmaneuver the aircraft, and yet they stayed illuminated, and there was no jet exhaust. A lot of the pilots in late war knew the difference between a propeller aircraft and the ME-262 when it came on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take long before they knew the characteristics of that jet, how it operated, how it combated. And the things that were being seen and labeled as jets had no kind of physical appearance to the sword. There were no dual burners, so there were, you know, it was a solid object constantly illuminated, and it just did not match, especially at night. So you can see where I'm going with this. The terminology was becoming a problem. Within the Army Air Force, Allied Air Forces.
Mm-hmm.
But they were still encountering phenomena in the mind.
Now, were there any kind of, you know, which has some organization, so to speak, within the military that was kind of set up in regards to tracking these things down, that they wanted to photograph them, get a more clear picture of what they're dealing with here?
Yes, there is, and for the longest time, researchers, UFO researchers, had based that information on, I think, Frank Edwards was the first to come out stating that in 1943 there was some type of investigation, British investigation, of the UFO phenomenon. And very little was confirmed. And so I wanted to find if that information existed. And I did find in 1943 there was a British operation in effect, and they called it rocket phenomena investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, they're applying the terminology to the objects. However, back and forth among the intelligence memoranda to the different bomb group level or bomber command, there was still discussion that though what they were seeing appeared to be rockets, it didn't make sense. So there was a confusion. And then by 1945, after the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force Command was set up in England under General Eisenhower, I discovered in January that the Scientific Intelligence Section, Advisory Section, was given the task to investigate the Foo Fighter phenomenon. And what's very interesting is, heading that investigation was Dr. Robertson. So I have the documentation that shows that he actually headed the investigation. And, of course, there were other elements involved with the documentation that stated the Air Technical Intelligence were also involved with investigating the phenomenon. And, of course, that takes us post-war to the 1953 Robertson-Pound Report, which has that amazing statement: if the term flying saucers had been popular in 1943 to 45, these objects would have been so labeled. So if it was rocket phenomena, if it was unconventional aircraft, it never has been revealed to be that exactly. There still is a mystery.
Right, right. And you mentioned Robertson. I guess his first name is Howard, right? Howard Robertson?
Yes.
And at this time, when he was doing this kind of work in around 1953, he was, wasn't he working for the CIA at that time?
Yes, he was hired. Yes, he was. I'm afraid his post-war activities, I can't recall offhand. But yes, of course, he headed the panel. He was the chairman for the CIA-sponsored
to look into this.
That. And that included Dr. Louis Alvarez, Dr. Louis Berkner, Dr. Samuel Goudsmit, Dr. Thornton Page. And of course, they brought in other people to provide information. And Robertson was heavily involved with all aspects of the higher echelon of the military starting in 1941. So if anyone knew what was being observed during the war, it would have been Robertson.
So do you think that they were also kind of keeping an eye on this for the idea that they were, you know, this phenomena potentially might be again a threat against national security or some other... they might have suspected that this was a new kind of weapon system developed by the, you know, the Axis powers or something like that. Might that have been the case?
Are you talking about the Robertson panel report?
Well, I guess previously, before that, I guess we could go back a little bit further back in regards to why they became interested in the phenomena at all to begin with.
Well, I'd say first and foremost, the first thoughts that would have come across the intelligence operatives the military commands would have been, we are possibly dealing with an advanced technology, German technology.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they explored all conventional sightings as such in terms of, I'm sure everything was looked at, are we dealing with a new jet? Are we dealing with new ordnance weaponry? Are we dealing with something that has been put together by their scientists that exceeds what we currently are aware of?
Mm-hmm.
So the terminology Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon was used. They could not always show that it was German. However, the documentation is so sparse, we don't know how much they actually knew, and of course that's why today is still considered a phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
But putting what I saw available and how the RAF and the Americans were reacting within their intelligence memoranda, there was a real confusion that took all the way to the end of the war.
Speaking about looking from the German point of view from this, I've heard many times that both the Axis power and the Allies kind of were looking at this phenomenon, suspecting that this belonged to the enemy, so to speak, and they were kind of very uncertain, you know, what this is and so forth. Have you been able to look into, you know, what the Germans thought that this was and so forth?
Yes. Unfortunately, again, I was not able to see official documentation. But I was able to speak with a veteran here in the States who, on January 1st, 45, had encountered a Foo Fighter over Germany. And at the time, he thought it was German technology used to track him, some type of tracking flare. But he was always curious why and how it could perform like it did and not appear on their radar.
Yeah.
If it was definitely a solid aircraft. So he was fascinated. The pilot of his aircraft went on after the war to believe that we were dealing with something far, far exceeding conventional wisdom, and he did not really believe it was German technology. But what the point is that after the war, this gentleman was attending a conference in Canada, and it was a lot of the aerospace industry personnel and were getting together, and they were, I don't mean aerospace, just the air industry.
Sure.
And they were getting together for a meeting, and at that meeting, an ex-intelligence officer of the 8th Air Force was brought in to talk about World War II. After it was over, the pilot walked up to the intelligence officer and said, "Well, you spoke about everything but the Foo Fighters." And the intelligence officer made a comment to him like, "Well, I didn't think anyone really would know what they were, but yes, I know quite a bit about the Foo Fighters. In fact, what happened with you?" And so the pilot said, "Well, on January 1st, I had this sighting." He said, "That's pretty amazing because I can specifically remembering at that time that we were interrogating captured German pilots, and they had mentioned seeing the same type of object." So that was the first time I heard personally through a veteran that occurred. Once again, I haven't seen the official documentation, but
sure,
everyone talks about it, and I'm hoping that there is a researcher out there to help bring this into play.
Interesting. You know, Keith, we're actually approaching the end of our first hour here, but we'd love to continue our discussion with you and talk more in the subscriber section about, you know, diving into a little bit more about the theories, perhaps, of what these things might be. Also talk about if any of the witnesses that you've spoken to have any ideas of what they might be, and if so, where they're coming from, or whatever it might be. So do you have time for us to continue?
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Perfect. But before we do that, though, I want to leave the last couple of minutes here open to you so you can tell people who are interested in getting a copy of the book so they can dive themselves deeper into the research, how they would go about easiest getting a copy.
Okay. Well, I guess the best way would be internet. You could get on the Amazon.com and or actually Anomalous Books. My book was put out by Anomalous Books.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be anomalousbooks.com. And that would probably be the easiest way. Type in my name, type in the book's title, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. And I don't think you'd have any trouble from there.
Excellent. Okay, so yeah, I got it right here. anomalousbooks.com/chester.html. That's the best way to get on that website and get a copy. So, okay, let's take a short break right here, Keith, but we'll see you at the other side of the break, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Creations Radio, and thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. Don't miss our excellent continuation of our discussion with Keith Chester, available in our members section. Tune in next Sunday when we have John Lash coming on the program. Until next time, take good care and all the best.